for argument, United States v. Smith. Mr. Brindley.
May it please the Court. My name is Beau Brindley, and I represent the defendant appellant, Kerry Smith. Mr. Smith comes to this Court appealing the District Court's decision at sentencing to forfeit 8 parcels of property. It's Mr. Smith's position that the only basis for finding that those 8 parcels were in fact illegal proceeds of illegal activity forfeitable in this case was by using Mr. Smith's proper protected statements. I think the exhibits cited in the government's reply and put in the appendices, as admitted by the agent during cross-examination at sentencing, contained information that came directly from Mr. Smith's statements. So if Mr. Smith's statements were improperly admitted, then I think the 8 parcels of property could not be properly forfeited.
I don't understand your argument that he wasn't advised that if he didn't sign the proffer, he couldn't be questioned about certain things. He had a lawyer.
He did, right? He did not at that time.
He had another lawyer. Okay.
He had a different lawyer.
Well, if you have a lawyer, why isn't that enough? Does your lawyer tell you what the significance of a proffer is and what happens if you don't enter into a proffer agreement?
I don't know what the lawyer told him, Judge.
Maybe he has a claim of ineffective assistance.
He may in that sense.
But that doesn't mean he has an appeal. I mean, you don't have both, right?
Well, I think sometimes you can have both on certain circumstances, Judge. But here, I think the issue is the record did not establish a knowing waiver. And I think there should
You're
be...
You're saying one. Every proffer agreement has to have a reference to Rule 11 in it, which isn't true. The person has a lawyer. The proffer agreement and other deals that the government makes with defendants, they don't have to recite the whole federal criminal code.
I agree with that, Judge. I agree with that. In this instance, with respect to Mr. Smith's proffer statements, Mr. Smith had taken the position that he was not instructed and presented that position at sentencing. Now, what didn't happen, Judge, is Mr. Smith did not give testimony indicating that he wasn't instructed by former counsel, and perhaps that testimony would make the issue a little bit more clear.
A little bit more clear? How can it possibly be thought? Can you think it clear? He has a lawyer.
Yes.
To tell him what a proffer is, right?
Presumably, Judge.
And you agree that the proffer agreement doesn't have to repeat the entirety of the federal criminal code.
I agree that the proffer agreement.
So if the lawyer doesn't do his job with the client, then he has a complaint about the client. He doesn't have an appealable issue.
Judge, I think the position that I guess I would take in response to that question is to say that I think that the record needs to establish some basis for having a knowing waiver of the rights.
No, we never see anything like that in these proffers are very common.
Yes.
We don't see certifications that this person was instructed as to what a proffer is.
We don't commonly see it. It might be better if practice.
No,
if we did,
it wouldn't
Judge.
Be better. It just clog up the works with a lot of. You think it's going to help these defendants to be given the federal criminal code? Yeah, read through this and make sure you understand it all.
I don't think giving the defendants the criminal code would help, Judge. No, but I do think that it would be better, and certainly would have been better in this case. If we had something in the record to indicate a knowing waiver. Now,
why? Because we don't require this in any other cases involving proffers.
This issue is, as I understand it, this issue in this form hasn't been raised that I have seen in other circumstances.
Now,
I think it would be a different situation, potentially, like I said before, if Mr. Smith had in fact given testimony and said he wasn't instructed. I think that would put the judge in a different position. He didn't do that in this instance, Your Honor. The position we've taken is that the record should reflect a knowing waiver.
What do you want to say about this substitute asset issue?
Judge, with respect to the substitute assets, we cited this case in the Tenth Circuit, U.S. versus Bornfield, which indicates that if a parcel is found to be proceeds of illegal activity, direct proceeds, It cannot also be subject to forfeiture. It's substitute assets. It's either forfeitable because it's proceeds or it's not. It can't be both forfeitable as proceeds and forfeitable as substitute assets. So that's my response to that particular argument from the government. With respect to the net worth theory the government proposed, I think the problem with the net worth theory in this case is that there was one claim of legitimate income for Mr. Smith. Everybody acknowledges he also had rental income. The government's answer to that in response, as I understand it, was to say that Mr. Smith had obtained the properties illegally in the beginning using drug money, so the rental income is tainted as a result. The problem is...
Well, what happens if you have, you know, you have a Rolls Royce and you're ordered to forfeit it and it vanishes? But you happen to have $300,000. But the government can't prove that it actually is the proceeds from your sale of your Rolls Royce to avoid the forfeiture. So isn't the government entitled to that $300,000?
So you sold the Rolls Royce. I'm trying to understand, Jed. I'm not. What happened to the Rolls Royce?
The Rolls Royce has vanished. We don't know what has happened to it. It's gone. But we know that the defendant has $300,000, which could be sale price of Rolls-Royce, but we don't know. Now, obviously, I should think, obviously, he has to give up the $300,000.
If there was no evidence of a legitimate source for the income, I think that's true. But in this instance, there was, everybody acknowledged, the government and the defense, that there was legitimate rental income. But if the rental income came from property that was bought illegally, then the government says the rental income's tainted. Our only point is that...
Well, you agree with that, don't you?
What's that?
You don't agree with that?
I do agree with that.
Yeah, okay.
My point on that is that the only way that they get to the claim that the properties were bought with the illegal proceeds of drug trafficking is by saying that Mr. Smith told them so in these statements that I have indicated... we believe were improperly admitted, and we've already discussed that. So with that, Judge, I thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Brenly. Ms. Robertson?
Thank you. May it please the Court. My name is Amanda Robertson, representing the United States here. This defendant, in his opening brief, did not challenge the district court's findings regarding substitute assets, the net worth theory, or the statutory presumption. So it would be our position that those issues are waived on appeal. The district court clearly found that the properties were forfeitable as proceeds based on the net worth theory, statutory presumption of 853. And, again, the only claim raised in the opening brief was whether or not the district court erroneously admitted part of the proffer statement. Regarding the defendant's proffer statement, we agree the only indication in this record that there was a waiver is the signed proffer letter. There's no evidence that it wasn't a knowing and intelligent waiver. The only evidence in the record is the proffer letter itself, and the proffer letter clearly sets forth in the acknowledgement that the defendant had discussed his rights with his attorney had discussed the rights with him, and that the defendant understood the rights, and he signed the proffer letter. And that acknowledgement in our letter is the same acknowledgement that this court has passed on in United States versus Dorch. Further, the cases that the defendant cites, Mezzanotto and Robinson, would both support that the burden is on the defendant. If the defendant wants to say that a waiver is not a knowing and voluntary waiver, the defendant is the one who has that burden. We can't come forward with evidence about what Mr. Smith's discussions were with his attorney. That would be the defendant's burden. And that's what the law is. And even today, for the first time, Mr. Brindley says, well, maybe it would have been clearer if my client would have stood up or testified. And that's true. The burden is on the defendant. And as we cited in our brief, we invited the defendant to make a statement that he wasn't advised, and he turned down our offer. At the transcript 261, page 80, we indicated, quote, the burden would be on the defendant to at least come forward and say, quote, you know what, back in 2007 when I entered into the proffer agreement, Mr. Rogers never advised me of these things. And it was clear to the government and the court that the burden was on the defendant. That's accurate, and we ask that you affirm the district court's decision.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Robertson. Mr. Brindley, do you have anything further?
Judge, I don't see that I have any time remaining, so I thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. And were you appointed?
I was indeed.
Okay, well, we thank you for your efforts on behalf of your defendant. We thank Ms. Robertson for her efforts as well. So our next case.